As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Our show features our team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. And they'll help you make the most of your money while cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. You'll get clarity on strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
It began long ago. Two young boys in an American town riding their bikes to school and Little League practice. Over the years, the boys became fast friends, united in their love for stories where things would go horribly wrong. Pour yourself a strong beverage and buckle up. You're in the shallow end with Schnepley and Toff.
We are only 7 episodes away from hitting the magic 100 number. And
I remember when Box hit 100, and I wasn't involved nearly as much as I am with this one.
Sure.
And thinking, damn, look what those guys did. They went and hit 100.
We're quickly approaching that, and we do have to come up with some kind of a shallow end celebration. And yeah. I've given it some thought, and yeah, lots of thought, in fact. And I've come up with nothing. So,
okay, good.
If you think of anything, let me know.
Okay, yeah, we'll come up with something. We'll come up with something. I'm relieved to hear you say you've given it a lot of thought and come up with nothing, because I've not given it much thought and have also come up with nothing.
Damn, so, I've wasted time.
To me, it shows the lack of value in hard work and thought.
Well, you're just, you know, working more efficiently than I am.
Okay.
I
like how you think.
Want to look at it that way.
Yeah, yeah.
We got an email. I want to go first, if that's okay with you.
Please do. Please do.
Got an email from one of our listeners, and the subject line was, I potentially have a potential story for you, my friends. And they go, hey, all y'all, despite my salutation, I'm actually from Rhode Island. I think it's wicked cool that there's a New Englander out there killing it, even if you do need to speak with such unnatural vocal rhythms. Yeah, yeah, I know. I work hard at it. Anyhow, where I live in Rhode Island, it's just about a mile away from where the Gatsby affair happened, which, if you think on it, is truly and actually a shallow end story.
Oh, cool.
Just to give you an elevator pitch, he goes on to talk a little bit about it. It was before the Boston Tea Party. And
wow.
Yeah, it's not ancient history. Well, it is for the United States, because that's about as ancient as the United States can get.
Right.
But it's absolutely weird. And I'm going to cover it today.
And it's called the Gatsby Affair?
Gatsby Affair. Yeah. It was a pretty ballsy move for the time. And this email is from Harlan, who goes on to say, anyway, I wanted to say thank you, really, so thanks, and be well, guys. Harlan, thanks for the email. Thanks for the idea. And I did a little research on it. It's a pretty entertaining story. Well, it is, you know, looking back on it a couple hundred years. The year is actually 1772. And there's a lot of tension in the 13 colonies at this point, of course. The British have continually tightened their grip, enforcing stringent trade laws in the aftermath of the 7 Years' War. They were desperately trying to recoup the costs of the conflict. So they were, you know, the stamp tax had come into play, of course, and they were also charging fees they would at customs for merchandise. They were stopping ships in the harbor and taxing whatever they had on board. And if the goods were not paid or the taxes were not paid for, then they confiscated the goods. It was intrusive. It was heavy handed, particularly in the bustling waters of Narragansett Bay, Rhode Island. Mm-hmm. And one of the most hated of these enforcers was Lieutenant William Duddingston of the HMS Gaspee. Now, let me tell you a little bit about this guy. Lieutenant William Duddingston, he had a huge ego, and he steered the Gaspee not just with his hands, but with an iron will and a sense of entitlement that really was overreaching. He's a British customs officer, and he's sailing up and down the bay looking for any excuse to harass the local sailors. He was kind of drunk on power.
He's essentially he's a dick.
He is a Lieutenant Dick, yes. Okay. So he's strutting about like he owns the place, thinking he's untouchable because he's got the crown's backing. He's stopping ships left and right. He's boarding them with no more than a, because I said so. And he's handing out fines like they're going out of style. And he's got this look about him, too. It was smug and cocky. They described it, you know, that way.
Yeah.
And he if he found even a hint of something that he could pin on the colonists, he did. He was the kind of guy who relished the power trip, you know?
Yeah.
He enjoys watching people squirm when he flexes his authority, using any flimsy excuse that he could find to grab more control. He acts like the local law does not apply to him. And the current governor at the time was Governor Wanton. And Governor Wanton tried to rein this guy in. But Duddingston just scoffed at him. Just waved his royal orders in the air like some kind of a golden ticket from Willy Wonka's chocolate factory or something.
Do you know who I am?
Do you know who I am?
Yeah.
And it's not just the colonists who are getting the sharp end of the stick here. Even the merchants who are just trying to make a living. And he's getting their goods. He's snatching them away. And also emptying their pockets in many cases. He was the kind of villain that you'd boo off the stage, except this was not a play. It was real life. And he was ruffling all the wrong feathers. The Gaspee had become a symbol of imperial oppression. And the tension, as I mentioned, was pretty high, but it starts to really increase. It reaches a peak when the Gaspee seized 12 hogsheads of undeclared rum from the sloop Fortune. Now, I had to look it up. Wow. A hogshead equals 64 gallons.
Holy cow.
Yeah. So 12.
That's a lot of rum.
That's a lot of rum. 245.5 liters. And Duddington's arrogance swelled. He was not content with patrolling the seas. He had the gall to not only seize the rum, but then haul the colonists before the court outside of their home colony, which trampled on their charter in the process. He took them to Boston and put them in front of a jury there or a court there.
Wow.
So public resentment was boiling. And so was the defiance within the colonies. When Duddingston met with Deputy Governor Darius Sessions, he was asked to justify his authority, and his response was nothing short of a slap in the face to Rhode Island's governance. He said, "You have no control over me." As the Gaspee continued its tyrannical reign, enforcing the crown's will with a mix of zeal and disdain, the spark of rebellion had been ignited. Now, there was a local vessel, a well-known one in the area. It was a packet ship. It was called the Hannah.
Okay.
And a packet ship is a much smaller vessel. It was helmed by a cunning captain. And it became the unlikely David to the Gaspee's Goliath.
A cunning captain.
A cunning captain. A cunning colonial captain.
If you will.
On June 9th, with the Gaspee hot on her heels, The Hannah led a merry chase through Narragansett Bay, and the chase was more than it seemed. It was a clever ruse. With local knowledge of the treacherous shallows, the Hannah's captain lured the unsuspecting Gatsby onto a sandbar near Warwick, where it found itself hopelessly grounded, literally in the shallow end. The news of the Gatsby's predicament spread like wildfire throughout Providence. They looked at it as a golden opportunity. This was a sitting duck, a chance for payback.
I'm picturing the locals lining up on the shore, just taunting the what was his name? Duddleston
or Duddingston?
Duddingston.
Yeah, they were definitely looking for some payback. So under the cover of darkness, a band of 55, led by merchant John Brown, set out with a sense of daring that, obviously has echoed down through centuries.
Things are a little different now, aren't they?
So there they were, a group of Providence locals in the dead of night rowing silently toward the Gatsby, which was still hopelessly stuck on the sandbar. And they're thinking, this is our chance. Duddingston, he's on the ship. He's in bed. He's thinking he's all safe and secure. And then
he's probably just thinking, when the tide comes back in, I'll be able to float back out to gotcha.
That's what they were waiting on. And so that's why the colonialists were acting so urgently.
They knew they were racing the clock.
Exactly. So out of the blue, these angry colonists are all of the sudden on the deck of the Gatsby. They came aboard like they just walked into their own backyard. There was no pushback from the crew.
Right.
They weren't expecting a middle of the night visit.
Of course not.
Duddingston, he hears the commotion. And so he's not having a good night. He comes out, and I'm picturing him in his, like, one of those night shirts, the old.
That's what I was picturing, exactly.
With a stocking cap, you know, on his head and
slippers, maybe.
Yeah. So he comes out to find out what's going on, and one of the colonists shot him in the groin.
Take that, Captain. And welcome to America.
And there he is on his knees, and all around him, these guys are tearing through his ship. Some just casually sat down at his desk and leisurely leafed through his paperwork.
Nice.
They were looking for anything they could use to show the British had been pushing them around and overreaching their authority.
This is fascinating.
Then things really heat up. They start, literally they heat up. They set the ship on fire.
Wow, it's not bad enough he got shot in the balls. They started to torch his own ship.
They torched it. They did allow him and the crew to go ashore.
Well, that was very kind of them.
Duddingston, in his bloodied nightshirt, clutching his groin as he crawls into a lifeboat. And the ship went up in flames, and it must have been quite a sight. And it was the symbol of all their problems with the British just burning away. And it wasn't just the burning of the ship. It was like a giant bonfire of all their frustration.
Oh, I can only imagine. Yeah.
And it lit up the night. They made sure everyone could see the flame. They went through the town, much like Paul Revere, waking everybody up. Just say, hey, come look at this shit.
The British are burning. The British are burning.
This was, and this was pretty early. This was before the Boston Tea Party. The aftermath was as dramatic as the attack itself. Duddingston, injured and humiliated, faced a sheriff's arrest for previous transgressions, although he was quickly bailed out by his superiors and sent to England for court-martial. You could tell the winds were starting to blow in a different direction.
Sure. It's not bad enough he got shot in the balls. He got court-martialed back home.
And his ship got burned.
So court-martialed, I'm guessing, on charges of dereliction of duty? I mean,
don't know for sure, but yeah, that would...
You allowed the Americans to do this to us.
Yeah. The crown was incensed. They were outraged. A royal commission of inquiry was assembled. High-powered and determined, yet they faced a very uncooperative Rhode Island. Despite their authority, they could not pin down the culprits. The commission floundered. No one would tell anybody who was involved.
Darndest thing. We have no idea who torched your ship.
Well, that's so weird.
That really happened? I just thought that was a rumor. They actually snuck aboard and torched your ship and shot your captain in the balls? Wow.
And then sent him packing back for court-martial.
If I hear anything, I'll let you know.
Okay, bye now. Close the gate behind you. Thank you. Don't let the dog out. Citizens of Rhode Island maintained that tight-lipped approach. Their loyalty to each other was unwavering, and no charges were filed. The Gaspee affair, as it has become known, was more than a fiery spectacle. It was a declaration that American colonies would no longer tolerate British overreach. The audacity of the raid and the culprits in plain sight yet beyond reach, it spoke volumes. Local courts sided with the colonists, and charges against Lieutenant Duddingston were a clear statement of where their allegiances lay.
Wow.
The act of defiance would echo down through the corridors of power in England and within the taverns and the town squares of America. It was a precursor to the revolution that would soon follow. And it was a testament to the independent American spirit of liberty and self-determination in those days. Just amazing. Just an amazing story.
Man, I would have thought nothing would be worse than to get shot in the balls.
And you know what? He was shot in the balls with a blunderbuss.
But then the indignity of that followed by, oh, by the way, you have to go back to England and face court-martial.
And your nightshirt's ruined.
And you lost your stuff on your ship. And, that's priceless. I'm surprised that I have never heard that story before.
No.
But that's a great, have make a hell of a film.
Wouldn't it, though? Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm from New England, and I'm not familiar with that story. Everybody knows about the Boston Tea Party, but not this.
Sure. That reminds me of the book 1776, David McCullough.
Oh, yeah.
And a buddy of mine at Disney saw it on the desk of a guy who was from Britain and had moved to America to work at Disney. So my friend sees the book 1776 on this guy's desk, and he just took a piece of notepaper and he said, no matter where you are in this book, I'd stop reading right now. You're going to hate the way it ends.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah.
We got an email a while ago for the Box of Oddities. We were out on tour, and when we go on tour, people will write and say, hey, you know, if you're in the area, come here, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And this guy wrote us from London, and he said, really love the podcast. If you guys ever can do a live show, we would love to have you come over. Just keep your hands off our tea.
Good. It's interesting to me, as you were telling that story, the fact that I would say the UK is probably... Great Britain is probably our greatest ally internationally. Mm-hmm. And to think that the relationship went from one of oppression to now single most valued, you know, diplomatic partner.
Yeah, it's quite an evolution, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. It's testament, I think.
I got my information from ushistory.org, gaspee.org, then the National Archives, and of course, thanks to Harlan for suggesting it.
Thank you, Harlan.
As we move into summer, so many plans, so many opportunities to do things that it can actually become stressful. And you don't want meals to become part of that stress. Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never frozen meal is chef-crafted and dietitian approved.
Yeah, JG's right. The only thing better than delicious meals are ready-to-eat meals that you can prepare in just 2 minutes.
No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping and cooking and cleaning up. Simply heat and savor the good stuff.
So what are you waiting for? Get started today and fuel up on your springtime food goals.
And it's tailored to your schedule. Customize weekly meals with the flexibility to get as much or as little as you need. You can pause or reschedule deliveries to suit your lifestyle.
Factor's your solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking.
We're celebrating Earth Day all month long. Look for the Earth Month Eats badge on the menu for the lowest carbon footprint meals.
Look, just head to factormeals.com/shallowend50. That's right. Use code shallowend50. That gets you 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box.
That's code shallowend50. At factormeals.com/shallowend50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
It's been called the single largest church in America because it's true. Welcome to Our Church of the Swollen Heart. Sitting on some 1,250 square miles in Central Florida, Swollen Heart is the largest non-denominational church anywhere in the country. But we're much more than a church. True, we offer only one service on Sunday mornings, and it's only in English, because that's what Jesus spoke. But it lasts just 12 minutes, including two collections, so you and your family can get on to what really matters: fun, food, and drink. Families just love our par 5 24-hole championship golf course with soaring river rapids and breathtaking waterfalls and real quicksand bunkers to challenge your game. If big game hunting is more your speed, Swollen Heart has you covered. Let your kids experience the thrill of stalking and killing real animals. Don't worry, you'll be shooting blanks. The animals are trained to fall over when they hear a gunshot. Just don't tell the toddlers. Someone mentioned thrill rides. Our amusement park, Great Flags over Orlando, is larger than those little Disney and Universal parks next door. And just in time for summer, buckle up for the new Vortex of Death roller coaster. Not a single NASA astronaut could make it without passing out. But maybe you've got the right stuff. After a day of adventure, you're bound to be hungry. Choose from one of our 176 restaurants with everything your Christian mouth can handle. In the mood for fish? Try Simon Peter's Fried Fish Frenzy or the Wedding Feast of Cana with bottomless jugs of wine and plenty of baskets left over. And those Christians 21 and older will enjoy the 12 Apostles Brewery with more beers on tap than anywhere else in Orange County. Feeling adventuresome? Try a 24-ounce Judas Ale and see what happens to your best friend. And every Sunday at 5 p.m., one lucky guest is chosen to play Pontius Pilate in a recreation of the trial of Jesus Christ. There's even an actor dressed as Barabbas. Ignore the cries of the crowd, set Jesus free, and get a commemorative coffee mug. On your way to the parking lot, make sure you visit our Garden of Gethsemane gift warehouse, a full acre of collectibles sure to remind you of your new favorite spot to worship Jesus and drop hundreds in cash. Our Church of the Swollen Heart, just off Interstate 4 in Orlando. Se habla español.
So Harlan, that listener who had just sent that story that JG just read, used the same email address that you should use if you have something you'd like us to know about. Lifeguard@shallowendpodcast.com. Amy, a listener, used that same email address when she wrote, "Hello, Lindsay and JG. I love the show, and listening last week to the episode about the badly exploded whale, I was taken back to the time I had to help with a beached whale myself. At the time, I was working for a local state park as a nature center employee in a small town in Lower Delaware, and we received a call that a juvenile whale had washed up on the beach. Somehow, despite being a 16-year-old, I was recruited to help the individual in charge of such things to go do some investigating on what could have happened and take measures and samples of the dead whale. Let me tell you, I was excited when we left the office. I must have driven the lady crazy, asking all kinds of questions on the way there. How big is it? What kind of whale is it? What did she think happened to it? She just shrugged it off. Didn't say much, which I thought was odd, but I was 16, so what did I know? Well, we rolled up to this particular beach the whale was on and threw open the doors to the old Jeep Cherokee we were driving, and I immediately noticed a smell that, well, wasn't great, but I thought it must just be a bad low tide. Anyone that's ever been at or near a beach will know what I'm talking about. That something is dead, heavy salty air, gross gunk funk that gets in your nose and sticks. It was that, but it was worse. I mean, way worse. I scrunched my nose up and looked at the lady in charge. She just gathered her tools up and we started trudging up the dune to the beach. We crested the top of the dune and the wind really hit us with a full funk and I about threw up right there. Oh, no. I looked toward the ocean and saw the whale and marveled at the sheer size of it. As we made our way down the beach closer and closer to this once beautiful creature so oddly placed on this stretch of beach, I wondered what happened to it. I asked my coworker. She informed me that it was one of the reasons we were there. We were going to find out. Well, this, of course, was said in a sharp tone that made it clear that she wanted to open her mouth as little as possible. And as curious as I was, I honestly agreed. At this point, we both were odd shades of green, trying not to turn around and let somebody else do this awful job. We finally made it to the whale, set up our tools, and got to work. First up, the measurements. 52 feet long. I don't remember how wide, but with the bloating, I'm not sure it really would have been accurate. We took skin and blubber samples and a few other tests in between walking away for a minute to try and breathe some fresh air. All in all, we were there for about 60 of the longest minutes of my life. The whole time I was trying to place the underlying odor that seemed slightly familiar, but just out of reach. When we'd taken our last measurements and samples, the heavy equipment moved in to push it to the gigantic hole they had dug in the sand up on the dune, parentheses, no dynamite for us, fortunately, and bury it in its final resting place. We both carried the equipment back to the Jeep, drove back to the office with all the windows down, hoping to blow the stench off of us. Newsflash, that doesn't work. Once back in my own car, I drove home to my parents' house. Remember, I was still a teenager, still with my windows down. Park in, walked up the stairs to the front door, met by my mother, who started to open her mouth to ask me something and quickly stopped, took a giant step back from me and asked, quote, what the hell that smell was? Cue my sign to burn all the clothes I was wearing that day. I just muttered dead whale and walked straight to the bathroom to scrub myself as long as the hot water lasted. I finally emerged smelling more like a human and less like a decomposing sea animal and went to see if they had saved me any dinner. My mom had made spaghetti and meatballs with a side salad for dinner. I was starving. Dove right in until she brought out the dressing. Italian. The oil-laden Italian dressing turned my stomach. It smelled vaguely like the rancid oil from that beached whale.
Oh, wow.
And while I can finally eat Italian dressing, it took me a good 20 years before I didn't want to vomit when I smelled it.
I thought she was going to say that it was Caesar dressing.
Oh,
yeah, cause it's
see what you did there?
Anchovies.
See what you did there?
But wow, that makes sense, though.
So did I blow up a dead beached whale? No. Was it an amazing experience? Absolutely. Would I ever want to smell that smell again? No way in hell. Hope you guys got a laugh out of my temporary misery, and rest assured, this was nowhere near the most shallow end story I could tell. I just thought it was a fun follow-up to an explosive whale tale. Yours, Amy from Delaware. Thank you, Amy.
Amy, we'd like to hear all of your stories. So, I mean,
please.
We appreciate you sending this follow-up. That's great, but keep them coming.
Hey there, I'm Dylan Lewis, one of the hosts of Motley Fool Money. Each weekday on Motley Fool Money, we talk through the business news you need to know and the stories moving stocks on Wall Street. On weekends, we dive into the industries shaping tomorrow and host the experts, authors, and executives that understand them. Tune in for insights, a long-term perspective on investing, and of course, stock ideas, plenty of them. To quote a listener, it pays to listen. Check us out and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Have you ever wondered what really happened to Amelia Earhart or the lost colony of Roanoke? Do you ever find yourself scouring the internet for vicious Victorians and their murders by gaslight? Or perhaps you're just sick and tired of women being constantly misrepresented or plain lied about throughout history? If so, join me, Katie Charlwood, history harlot and reader of books, on Who Did What Now, the history podcast that's not your history class. Part of the Airwave Media Network. Available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Adios, au revoir, au revoir de zen, my friends. Bye-bye. I'll be seeing you.
You're in the shallow end with Schnepley and Toth.
We have covered our share of bank robbery stories here on the shallow end, and most of them, I think you would agree, JG, have involved very poor decisions. Some of them were gutsy, like those two guys in Vail, Colorado, remember, who skied down the trail riding a chairlift and then robbed a neighborhood after robbing a neighborhood bank. And then there was that guy a few stories ago who wrote, "Give me the," without finishing the note because he was too high on crack to finish the sentence. But I think only one story has involved actually a female bank robber, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, I can only think of one.
And I don't know if I would call this a bank robbery story, but you'll see why I thought of those stories when I jump into this one.
Okay.
Because we here at the Shallow End celebrate the stupidity of both men and women when it comes to dumb crooks, and this one's a doozy. Our charming little story takes place in a small town called Ashtabula, Ohio. That's about 50 miles northeast of Cleveland, Ohio. Have you ever been to Cleveland?
Yes, a few times.
I never have. I never have. I want to go there someday. Isn't that where the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is?
Yeah, that would be the reason I would want to go now. When I was there, I think it was pretty early in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame's history. And to be fair, I just kind of drove through. So,
but you can say you've been.
Legally, I can claim to have been in Cleveland.
There you go. I've got a very good friend who was born there, and I don't think he ever goes back, but I'll have to ask. Now, for reasons, Jethro, that will become clear in a minute, I kind of have to tell this story somewhat out of order. It starts at about 5 p.m., and this was just last Monday. This was March 4th. Police in Ashtabula get a call from the local hospital, and their emergency room has called the police for a rather odd reason. Somebody, they don't know who, has dropped off a human body in the ER without identifying either the deceased person or even themselves. It's just they park this dead body in the ER and they just left.
Wow.
So a few hours later, one of those people who dropped off the body actually calls the hospital and they say, "Oh, by the way, that body that showed up in your ER today, here's the information on who that person is." And they give the hospital details. So now the ER knows that they have the remains of a gentleman named Douglas Lehman, also of Ashtabula, Ohio. He had been 80 years old. So now at least the police figure, okay, we got the guy's name. So they find out his address and they send some cops to his house because now they're looking to see, you know, what can we find out about this deceased individual? Maybe talk to some neighbors, see if his family is still there, something like that.
Right.
Well, there are two women there at the house, and they seem a tad nervous, like they know something that the cops don't yet know. And their names are Laureen Ferrallo. She's 55 years old, and a 63-year-old woman named Karen Kasbaum. Come to find that those two had been living in Douglas's home for some time. They would run errands for him. Sometimes they would take him, out so he could get some fresh air and get out of the house. And neighbors thought, well, this was kind of nice of them to, you know, take the time to do this. So over time, they even took care of his money for him. They would drive to the bank and withdraw money and, you know, buy groceries and kind of caretakers. And kind of surprisingly, the bank said, well, as long as he's with you, you're fine, which sort of amazes me, but it's a small town bank.
Sure.
Well, They had done that very thing earlier that day. They had driven with Douglas to the bank. He's sitting in the front passenger seat of his own car. And they go through the drive-through teller, the drive-through lane. And the teller sees Douglas sitting in the passenger seat. And they withdraw actually $900 in cash. Teller sees Douglas with these two kindly older women. She counts out $900 in an envelope and, you know, waves goodbye as the three of them drive away. One little hitch here. Douglas was already dead when they drove to the bank.
This is some real Weekend at Bernie's shit.
Weekend at Bernie's is precisely what I was thinking of. Now, the cops are kind of working backward to piece together the series of events, and they come to find that the women had placed Douglas, quote, in the vehicle in such a way that he would be visible to bank staff in order to make the withdrawal, unquote. And the two women say, they tell the cops, honestly, that they had found Mr. Lehman deceased earlier that day where all three of them lived. But right now, we really don't know much earlier than that exactly how he died, when he died, the cause of death. But the police say that these two women, with the help of actually a third as yet unnamed person, placed Douglas in the front seat of the car and drove him to the bank. God. Like I said, we don't even know who the third person was. Did that person even know that Douglas was already dead? Did they think he was asleep? We don't know. We do know they drove to the bank and took out $900. And they then drove to that hospital, the Ashtabula County Medical Center, and dropped off Douglas's body and left without providing any information about the man or themselves.
Why would they do that?
We don't know, and we're hoping to find out. But last week, those two women, Karen and Laureen, were charged with, quote, gross abuse of a corpse and theft from a person in a protected class. And both of those charges are felonies. It's unclear whether these women have attorneys. Phone numbers listed in their names had been disconnected. Police are continuing the investigation and say that other charges are possible. The coroner's office says that they are going to perform an autopsy to determine the cause of death, but they're going to say, believe it or not, that could take up to 8 months. And I can't for the life of me figure out why it would take 8 months for an autopsy to determine cause of death.
That's weird.
But it turns out that these two women are not exactly, they're probably not, you know, leading like a Girl Scout troop or something like that. The one of them has a rap sheet with convictions for reckless assault, possession of drug paraphernalia, criminal trespass, DUI, theft, and attempted possession of drugs. This woman was arrested in 2022 for possession of fentanyl. And the other woman, previously convicted of theft, solicitation, criminal trespass, receiving stolen property, possession of drug paraphernalia, and attempted drug abuse. Which leads me to what you just said. I think it would be so ironic if the three of them, meaning the two women and Douglas, the deceased, ever sat together and watched Weekend at Bernie's and laughed out loud.
Yeah, maybe that was their inspiration.
Maybe so.
You're just causing more problems for yourself. If you just took him back and put him in his bed and then called 911, I don't know.
Something made them think, well, we really need that $900. So let's take him to the bank. Let the teller see him. We'll withdraw the $900. And then, you know, we're not total jerks. We'll take him to the hospital and leave him there at the ER. It's just so freaking weird.
It is. I don't get that at all.
Got this story from the Ashtabula Star Beacon newspaper, The Smoking Gun, and News 5 Cleveland. Weekend at Bernie's at the bank.
I am going to follow that story closely. I'm really interested to learn a little bit more of the backstory there, but
it's weird.
Weekend at Bernie's.
I wouldn't have actually, I mean, as funny as Weekend at Bernie's was, I wouldn't ever think that somebody could actually pull that off.
Not the water skiing scene, that's for sure.
No. No, that's true.
It's ridiculous.
But what if we ever hear about that in real life? You can you can be damn sure we'll talk about it here on the show.
Of course we will.
That's for sure.
Yeah. And if you hear about it, you can let us know at lifeguard@shallowendpodcast.com.
And see, folks, that was a masterclass in what we call the segue in broadcasting. That was about as seamless a transition as an excuse to mention lifeguard@shallowendpodcast.com as there has ever been.
Well, thank you, sir.
My hat is off to you, Jethro.
Why are you still wearing hats? You know, that went out of fashion in the 40s.
I like the look. Do you like this one?
Is that a fedora?
It is a fedora, yeah.
Very nice. Yeah. Well, it's you're an excellent judge of quality haberdashery.
Thank you.
You're welcome, my good friend.
Damn it, thank you. I truly appreciate that. Lifeguard@shallowendpodcast.com. Please send us your letters, your compliments. Keep your complaints to yourself because, as we've said in the past, what are you paying for this thing anyway?
Yeah, right? Mm-hmm.
Nothing.
Nothing. It's free.
So, it's free, and it always will be. Unless we decide to charge down the
right.
road. Just wanted to cover ourselves.
Give us the option.
Thanks, as always, JG, for an entertaining yarn.
Yeah, well, thank you, sir. And we will look forward to seeing you next time. Make good choices, people.
Your life might depend on it.
So concludes another episode of The Shallow End with Schnepley and Toff. We thank you for listening. Oh, be a dear, would you? Please subscribe to this podcast, give these boys a 5-star rating, and think of something nice to say, even if you have to make something up. And visit us online at shallowendpodcast.com. Okay, gotta go.
What do you get when you take two childhood friends with a passion for unexplored history and a whole lot of booze?
You get us, Queens Podcast.
And here at Queens, we are spilling the tea on all kinds of women from history.
From New Orleans voodoo queen, Marie Laveau, to Marie Antoinette, and everything in between.
Each queen is paired with a cocktail recipe that will totally get you in the mood to hear the fun, dramatic, and juicy stories of fascinating women from history.
Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Cheers.
Hello everyone, Takuya here.
And I'm Gabby.
And we are the hosts of History of Everything, a podcast which you can probably guess by the name is, well, I mean, it's about everything. Do you want to know why people thought potatoes were evil and would give you syphilis? Are you curious about all the stories of the terrible and stupid ways that people have kicked the bucket over the years? Do you want to hear tales about all of the different badasses of history and the lives that they had brought to life? Well, if so, then look no further. History of Everything is just the right podcast for you. It's available on Spotify, Pandora, and anywhere else that you get your podcast from. Join us for some fun and just see how weird and wacky history can be.